I'd like to welcome and introduce to you Professor Colin Harvey, who is Professor of Human Rights Law at Queen's University, where he was formerly head of school and probably relieved to be rid of that managerial responsibility. Colin has a distinguished career. He was Professor of Constitutional Law and Human Rights at Leeds University and held visiting positions at the University of Michigan, Fordham University and London School of Economics. He edits a number of magazines and has written extensively articles and books. Colin has also held a number of roles in civil society, and among them he served on the Human Rights Commission here in Northern Ireland, and there are many other things that I could tell you about him. But I'd like to tell you that he's a thoroughly nice guy. He's very helpful, clear and razor sharp in his thinking, and he has been extremely helpful to me on many occasions around issues to do with the law and dealing with the past in particular. So, Colin, we look forward to hearing from you. We know that this is the first time you've entered these hallowed halls. So we hope you will survive your visit with us and look forward to hearing from you.
Thank you very much, Leslie. I did not recognise for one second the person being described there, but I thought he'd come up and stand here anyway and talk to you all. Welcome. Still good morning, I think. Just like to thank Norman for the invitation to be here this morning. It's the first time I've been here, and I'm absolutely delighted to be here with you today to primarily, I think, listen and to learn. And today has already been a learning experience for me, and throughout the day, look forward to listening, hearing the discussion, and thinking about a bit more about the topic. In a sense, that's going to be a theme of my talk today. I think the need to listen. As Leslie reminded me over coffee as well, listening is a way of also being in the public square as well. So thank you very much for the invitation. I think the aim of my talk, there is no question mark. I can't see. There's no question mark there. Faith in human rights in two senses of that term, in both senses of the term. Today, I want to say something first of all about faith in human rights, primarily in human rights law as it exists today. But I also want to say something about faith in human rights as a belief in human rights and all those locally and globally who struggle around the world for human rights and equality and for social justice. Very, very conscious in this audience today that I am an academic lawyer. I had legal academic there, but I thought that was a bit of confusion. So I'm an academic lawyer. I am not a theologian, so you'll all keep me right, I think, today in these discussions. The first thing I want to start off by saying is this, and it's an observation. After today, or perhaps even during my speech today, if I don't send you all to sleep, I can see all the iPads there, and you're all networked up, so you can all immediately Google everything I say. So either after today or on your iPad now, just have a look at the Universal Declaration of Human Rights from 1948. Look at the legal language that is used in the Universal Declaration of Human Rights 1948 throughout all of its provisions. Look at the language that's used in the International Covenant of Civil and Political Rights of 1966. Look at the language of the European Convention on Human Rights from 1950 and its protocol. I would guess that even if you had never looked at a legal document in your life before, that you would recognize, be familiar with, and empathize with much of the language in those documents. Because I suppose a starting point for my observations today is just how much the modern human rights movement, those who struggle for the recognition of human dignity and human rights today, are in a sense working against a backdrop and standing on the shoulders of centuries and decades of theological thought. And I want to put that out there now. And that thought has influenced and informed the human rights legal standards, the human rights law and politics that we have today. And don't take my word for it. Just read the Universal Declaration of Human Rights, 1948, and let me know and see what you think. Human rights. Another starting point, and again a starting point that I think is informed by theological reflection and its influence on human rights. The great tragedy of the modern age, I think, is that human rights language, when we think about human rights, when many of us think about human rights this morning, we tend to think about an atomized language of individualism. My rights, I have rights. I'd like to start again by making this observation that human rights is intrinsically relational, social, and ultimately an intrinsically communal notion. Because if I engage in the public square and I argue for human rights, surely I am not in the public square simply arguing that Colin Harvey only has human rights. At the core of the argument for human rights is that all human persons should have these rights as well. And really, I think it's an awful tragedy in much of the modern portrayal of human rights that that social and relational, universal understanding of human rights as belonging to all human persons, to all human beings, universally, is neglected and underplayed in favor of a rather more individualistic discourse of human rights. Another observation about the public square. I chaired a working group of the Irish Interchurch Committee last year, reflecting on where we are now, 15, 16, however many years after the Belfast Good Friday Agreement, and processes of renewal and change. I just want to make this observation about what I heard, in underlining again that I was, in a sense, listening and learning from others. Put this question out there. Should the right to engage in the public square be the starting point? My sense was, in listening to the conversations that are happening around this island now, that the tone is one of humility, of acknowledgement of past failings, and raising questions about the right to engage in the public square at all. What I mean by that is this, that a protracted period on this island of listening to the voices of women, the voices of children, the voices of the LGBTI community, the voices of minority ethnic communities? Should that be the priority for the time ahead? A process of humility that involves also listening to the voices of oppressed others. Second point I want to make, and it follows on from the first presentation this morning. I don't think we should get inherently legalistic about some of these debates, but it does bear pointing out that international human rights law, the standards I've referred to already, do recognize and reflect the right to religious freedom, and they also recognize and reflect the importance of equality and non-discrimination, of not discriminating against people because of their religious beliefs. Look at the Universal Declaration of Human Rights, 1948, Article 18. The European Convention on Human Rights, Article 9 and Article 14. The American Convention on Human Rights, 1969, Article 12. The African Charter of Human and People's Rights, 1981, Article 8. The International Covenant on Civil and Political Rights, 1966, Article 18.1 and Article 22. The General Comment number 22 from the UN Human Rights Committee. Even look at the European Charter of Fundamental Rights, Article 10 and Article 22. Look at the UN Declaration on the Elimination of Intolerance or Discrimination Based on Religion or Belief, 1981. Examine the work of the UN Special Rapporteur on freedom of religion or belief, and look at the number of laws and policies around the world from comparative perspective that incorporate the right to freedom of religion and the right to non-discrimination in national legal processes. So there's widespread recognition of the right in international law. But what I think is missing is this, that skepticism about the discourse of human rights, a concern about engaging in the discourse of human rights, risks, I think, neglecting the scope there is for development at the international, regional, and national levels at expanding and explaining what the right to religious freedom means today. In other words, you'll notice that at the UN level, for any lawyers in the room, a UN declaration is normally followed by a UN convention. Well, in relation to religious freedom, that hasn't happened. I suppose the question I would ask is that work in progress to be engaged in and thought about? The European Convention on Human Rights, the European Court of Human Rights, although it's developing its thinking on Article 9, that's still work in progress. The courts are still struggling with these issues. They're struggling to come to terms with these issues. And I think that when anybody is struggling to come to terms with an issue like that, that suggests to me the need for engagement, the need for reclamation, for reclaiming a discourse that borrows, takes from centuries of theological thought, and engaging in that discourse and helping those who are trying and struggling to understand as they go forward and try and interpret law and policies in pluralistic and diverse societies. I think that suggests to me the need to promote essentially healing conversations. We are particularly good in this society at promoting conversations that are the reverse of healing. So where possible, I think it would be good if we could promote here, locally and globally, more healing, consensual conversations on what the human right to religious freedom means today in our pluralistic, interfaith, and intercultural context. Take you back to the earlier point about human rights, that I'm not arguing for the human rights of Colin Harvey. I'm arguing for the human rights of every person in this room. Dare I mention something like the Bill of Rights? If you argue for a Bill of Rights, you're not arguing for a Bill of Rights just for you. Well, you'd be slightly odd if you are. You're arguing for a Bill of Rights that would apply to every single person in this room and beyond this room. We need healing conversations that reflect the human right to religious freedom and what it means today in the context of a pluralist society. Because it seems to me that if you believe in the concept and the human right to religious freedom, you're also making an argument about religious pluralism. And any legislator in a society that is pluralistic and diverse is facing the challenges and a conversation that can promote understanding about what that human rights means today would help. Now, in that statement, I referred to interfaith and intercultural contracts, but I want to also underline and stress intra. It seems to me wrong to suggest for any community that there is one monolithic understanding of what any community means by human rights and equality. That doesn't have to be faith communities. It can be any institution or community. I think in those conversations, there needs to be a recognition that there is both the need for interfaith and intercultural dialogue, but also intra-faith and intra-cultural dialogue. And that intra-cultural dialogue has to be open to ways of ensuring the participation of individuals and communities within faith communities who have been traditionally rendered invisible and silenced in those debates. So I'd say that those who are in a position, not me, right, because I'm an academic sitting in Queens, but legislatures and policymakers who are genuinely struggling with these issues in modern, diverse, pluralistic societies, how can they be helped to promote better and more respectful conversations about the relationship between the human right to religious freedom and equality in the modern setting? I think we also, all in this room, have to acknowledge the dilemmas of the legislature. I know many of us aren't open to that on occasions and thinking about politicians, but the dilemma that anybody operating in a legislative capacity faces in the modern age. We have to acknowledge that legislators today are very often legislating for diverse and pluralistic societies in all senses. And the challenges that they face in legislating for diverse and pluralist societies and what we can do to help to promote healing conversations in those contexts. Third point I want to make is just to say, look, my starting point today is if the only time I hear my voice out loud in the public square is talking about me, I worry about that. I think human rights for me starts with the human rights of the other, with how we can better serve the other, with a recognition of our common humanity, with a recognition of a common humanity without borders. And with the challenging question today for all of us, who is my neighbour? And in that context, and to move on a bit, I'd make a plea for us today to also reflect on the human rights of refugees, asylum seekers, and the forcibly displaced. Over 50 million persons around the globe last year were forcibly displaced from their homes as a result of persecution, human rights abuses, conflict, or generalized violence. Forced displacement, it is a staggering global scale. People are dying on boats trying to get
to Europe. Laws, policies, and practices that are operational across Europe are contributing to the problems that refugees and asylum seekers face. I want to put out there today the vital role, the key role around the world that faith communities have in struggling for a more humane approach to the plight of refugees and asylum seekers, in ensuring that people who are often forced to rely only on their common humanity are respected, protected, and sheltered. And I think we all could do more, both to recognize the role that we already have, but the work that we can do in making the human in human rights meaningful. Another theme where I see faith communities working together and building coalitions around the world is on the theme of social solidarity and social justice. So for me today, human rights do not just mean the traditional civil and political rights that we have traditionally understood them to mean, but also the recognition of economic and social rights, what a fully dignified human life looks like today, the role that faith communities have and must have today in challenging socioeconomic systems of domination and oppression around the world that condemns millions of people around the world to live in poverty. How can we ensure that people around the world live dignified lives that respect their rights and human dignity? In other words, it seems to me that that goes beyond charity, and that's also an important element of the human rights conversation. Not just food banks, but how can human rights and equality help to confront the social and economic structures that make food banks necessary today? I suppose what I'm really saying is there are many people around the world who are struggling for a better world, who want to change the world, who want to challenge and confront, and they are doing so because of their faith, and they see it as an intrinsic part of their faith. There are also people around the world who are struggling to make a better world and would not describe themselves in those terms at all, but are advancing the same overall purpose. And the question I would ask is that where consensual and healing conversations can be built, where coalitions can be formed, where people can find ways to work together towards a common purpose, that the discourse of human rights in particular can provide a language for people to work together. So just to end, you'll be glad to hear, what am I saying? First of all, I'm saying that many people struggle globally and locally here for human rights and equality precisely because of their faith. Secondly, I'm calling for, in some senses, a reclamation, an engagement and participation in the language and discourse of human rights to give shape to that language. There is a human right to religious freedom. There's a right not to be discriminated against. If people need to be better informed when they interpret the meaning of those rights today, then that strikes me as being about participation and engagement, and there is an element of that that involves engagement in the public square. However, a big theme of what I've also been saying is need to listen. I need to listen, I think, at this point, but the need to listen to others. And in the interfaith and intercultural dialogue, and probably just as importantly, the intra-dialogues, the voices of those who have historically been silenced, marginalized, who have experienced domination and oppression and need to be heard in those conversations, and people need to listen. Yes, the debate today is about freedom of religion, but that means the human rights of other peoples too, the human rights of others as well. Just to end, I had great pleasure last year of chairing a working group of the Irish Interchurch Committee. I'm going to end by reading you out some of the recommendations, because these documents tend to end up on somebody's website or shelf and they never get read. But just want to read you out a recommendation of that working group, a number of them. The working group wishes to underline the reconciling purpose of God in our world. We believe that the mission of the churches in Ireland remains to awaken faith in Christ and promote understanding of the will of God through a new evangelization securely based on our shared gospel values. To this end, the IICC should, 1, demonstrate consistently the Christian belief in a radical and transformational culture of peace and non-violence that upholds respect for human dignity, social solidarity, human rights, and the common good. And skipping to recommendation 11, encourage inter-church cooperation to affirm the example of those who work for social justice, human dignity, human rights, and the common good. Recommendation 12, enhance existing inter-church engagement with refugees, asylum seekers, migrants, and minority ethnic communities as practical expression of our global and universal commitment to human dignity and human rights. Thank you for listening.
Okay, thank you, Colin. You happy sitting?
I don't care.
And I'll dander.
You tell me what to do.
I tell you what to do. Yeah. I want to thank Colin for his challenge, which takes us from a kind of narrower, localized vision of human rights and out into the much bigger world of human rights, and reminds us that there are world dimensions to all of this in your social justice recognitions, etc. And I guess, Colin, part of what you are inviting us to do is to reframe what we are already doing. So as Christians, Presbyterians, and people of other denominations, we do a lot of social justice work, whether through parachurch organisations or on our own, whether it be Christian Aid, Tear Fund, Trocra, or whatever. And that social justice work is something we are already doing. And you're inviting us, I hear, to reframe what we do and reclaim that into a human rights kind of perspective. So to say to us, it's already within us rather than something is outside of us. Is that right? Is that what you were in part saying to us?
I can speak through this. I suppose it was the observation is that if you take the example of the Universal Declaration of Human Rights and the language that's used, that it is a legalistic language, but it's a language that's so clearly informed by theological reflection going back decades and centuries, particularly around notions of human dignity and human rights. And I think it would seem to me, from whatever context or from whatever perspective in the debate that you are in, that there seems to me a tendency of walking away from the debate, of walking away from, in a sense, engaging with the discourse. And that seems particularly odd to me in the area of human rights. In the area of human rights, because it is so clearly anchored in the recognition of the dignity of each and every human person. that if there's work to be done, that work can be done within the language of human rights and by engaging in human rights. And some of the advances that have been made by individuals and communities around the world have been through, if you like, mobilizing and engaging with the discourse itself. My only other concern then was that, yes, the right to religious freedom is definitely work in progress. And I think that's fairly widely acknowledged in the legal literature as well. It's still work in progress, so clearly calling for engagement too. But it's also to bear in mind that where you engage in the public square, and this applies to any of us, right? That if you're only ever heard in the public square arguing for your own interests, I just wonder how that sounds in the wider world.
Okay, I think you put your finger early in what you said. You put your finger on what is a concern that I hear from many Christian people about the whole human rights agenda. You said the tragedy of human rights is that it has become the atomized language of individualism, whereas human rights is intrinsically relational and communal in history and notion and demand, in fact, that it makes from us. How did that happen? How can we resist that? How can we as Christians be in the public square in a way that resists that atomization of the language of individualism?
It's absolutely clear that the more communal language of the Universal Declaration of Human Rights and other international human rights instruments was informed by the participation and engagement in the conversations that led to the drafting of those instruments of faith communities. And it seems to me that the discourse of human rights is and has, as a consequence, been enriched through that. So I think, first of all, there is a need to engage. There's a need to promote a proper understanding and interpretation of what human rights means. There is a risk that in modern consumerist societies, that when people hear rights, they just think about me, 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 me. It becomes a selfish, individualistic discourse. But of course, you know, the clue in human rights, right? The clue in human rights is in the title, right? The clue has always been there. When I argue for human rights, I'm arguing that every human person has these rights. How can that possibly be an argument just about me?
Okay, you on a number of occasions, thank you for that, Colin, on a number of occasions you spoke about the need for healing conversations, collaboration, cooperation, and healing conversations. What, from your perspective and your experience, both academically but also in the other various areas of life, civic life in which you work, what do you think the healing conversations are that need to happen in Ireland today?
I mentioned this document, and not just because, you know, I chaired the working group. I learned a lot doing it, but it did come up with a number of recommendations. And one of the key points to emerge from those discussions is the need for listening and the need to, with humility, talk to each other. You know, I mentioned earlier the issue of refugees and the rights of refugees. I think we're rapidly getting to a point where you could organize an event on the rights of refugees and asylum seekers in Europe today or in Belfast. And Norman could be organizing the event and you would get a certain group of people in the room and another group and you would get a different. And what it always strikes me is that people aren't talking to each other about areas where they may have common concern and a common shared purpose. And in the context of our society, we need to find ways to bring people together to listen respectfully to each other. And perhaps provocatively raised the question about tone. It's a big issue in Ireland, north and south, right? For me. And the issue is this, you know, there are many people on this island who might have the view that if the churches on this island spent the next century listening to the voices of the people of this island, to the voices of, for example, women and children on this island, that that would be a very, very appropriate way to engage in the public square as a starting point. So I think in humility, in recognizing that going forward, an important element of that is in listening to people who aren't normally heard in these conversations.
Okay, thank you for that. And then it becomes our responsibility to identify who the people are that we are not normally listening to, or who may be sitting among us in silence because they don't know how to speak. So that becomes a responsibility on us as church people.
I think that one of the, in this document and in some of the conversations, a lot of thought, how do you promote, like I put a lot of emphasis on consensus and healing conversations, but it's absolutely clear that a number of those conversations will be challenging conversations and that not everybody agrees with each other. But in the context of a pluralistic society, right, in the context of a society that recognizes, for example, religious freedom, i.e. pluralism being intrinsic, then we need to find ways to promote dialogue, for example, between the churches and all areas of civil society, a dialogue that is about listening both ways. You know, where there is a profound and deep misunderstanding of religion today, there is a need for listening. Secular society, atheism, needs to listen as well. But I think the healing work that can be done is to bring people into respectful dialogue with each other. It particularly strikes me with legislatures, with anybody charged with making laws and policies for diverse societies who are grappling, whether they are politicians, whether they are judges, whoever they happen to be, we're grappling to adjudicate or make decisions on complex and difficult areas where there is profound disagreement. Where civil society, where institutions can help in promoting dialogue, promoting conversations, where we are listening to each other. But I do think, and this is something I just noticed on a very practical level in working in something like social justice, just the tragedy of people working for exactly the same sort of world who just weren't talking to each other.
Okay, so you've identified a number of helpful things for us, Colin. One is the listening, and the other is promoting conversation and dialogue, and in that way being part of the conversation and dialogue. Just for the last couple of minutes, I want to take you to something that you dared to mention, which was the Bill of Rights. So many of us within the church have found the Bill of Rights process a difficult one. We're not opposed to it in the sense of a Bill of Rights in itself, but to many of us, the promotion of an all-singing, all-dancing, cover-all-bases Bill of Rights feels like another legalistic oppression that's going to tie us into massive knots. So, kind of interested to know, where is that process at, how you feel about it, where it might be going? Just reflect a little bit around the Bill of Rights.
One thing is that people like me have a responsibility to try, you know, talking out in favor of human rights sometimes can be quite a tough, and particularly the Human Rights Act at times, which seems to get blamed for all the ills of the world. But What always seems odd to me is those who are engaging in human rights are trying to say that there may be a framework here. It may be a legal framework or a policy framework that starts from the premise of what we share. And what we share is a common humanity. And in that framework, there might be a basis for conversation and dialogue. And that I think the human rights debate needs to be more emphasized and framed in that context. Those who talk about human rights are trying to say there may be useful tools here to get us in a room together to at least recognize the things that we share with each other. On the Bill of Rights, without revisiting, I've traumatized about the Bill of Rights. I was on the Human Rights Commission, involved in the Bill of Rights process. I'll just say it out loud, right? I think there should be a Bill of Rights. And I was involved in the advice that went to government in 2008. And I still think there should be a Bill of Rights for this reason. I think this society needs an ambitious framework that recognizes our common humanity, that recognizes what human dignity means today and what a dignified life looks like today. And for me, it was always reasonably easy in a sense. I think the recognition that people's social and economic status and entitlements should be framed in rights terms. It's not just charity that is what people hold, was not an outrageous proposition to make when you're advising government on what should be in a Bill of Rights. It seemed to be there in a lot of international instruments around the world. A lot of other societies were doing it as well. To recognize that a fully dignified human life today would also include a recognition of the fact that people should have certain basic economic and social rights guaranteed in law did not and still does not seem to me to be an outrageous proposition. So I still think this society could use an aspirational, a Bill of Rights that sets out a standard of achievement for now and for the future. But that seems to me part of a bigger question, right? Whatever way you want to frame it. People are right to be ambitious for Northern Ireland. You know, human rights and equality advocates are right to be ambitious for this society, just like others want to be as well. I think there were expectations created around our process that people are right to have. I think they were not immediately delivered overnight. They often never can be, but I think they're right that they're there. There's work in progress. There's still things that need to be done, and people are perfectly entitled to be ambitious for this society, for human rights and equality. Why can't we look around the world, look at what people are doing constitutionally, look at what's just happened in the debates around the Scottish referendum, to think ambitiously, to borrow, to take examples, to make us the best there is in the area of constitutional law and human rights law and equality law too. Why can't we be ambitious in that area too? Again, it doesn't seem to me to be an outrageous thing to say.
Okay, so if you think it's an outrageous thing for Colin to have said, you can speak to him over lunch. But I want to thank him again and thank him for the reminder in particular that human rights are intrinsically relational and communal in their ambition and practice. And that is an important reminder for us, Colin. I thank you for it. And I hear the challenge to us to reclaim the language and to breathe life back into this notion of rights, to take it away from individualized legalism, if you like. So thank you for being with us today.